In 1968, George Romero brought us Night of the Living Dead. It became the classic horror film of its time.
It gets up and kills. The people it kills get up and kill.
Now, George Romero brings us the most intensely shocking motion picture experience for all times. Dawn of the Dead.
This situation must be controlled before it's too late. They are multiplying too rapidly.
Night of the Living Dead has ended. Dawn of the Dead is here.
Not that room! Not that room!
They must be destroyed on sight!
Dawn of the Dead. This picture contains scenes of violence that may be considered shocking. No one under 17 will be admitted. Dawn of the Dead. From United Film Distributing Company.
In the big room, the tension is thicker than ever. A few of the newsmen still earnestly try to perform their various functions, but most of the crew are reduced to emotional polarization over the broadcast, which still rages. They wore faces of stone. It was as though any mention of crisis would crack their seemingly calm exteriors. But the burden of staying calm was even greater with the sound of the agitated discussion that was being played over the airwaves in counterpoint to the newspeople's desperate actions. TV Man 1.
All right, Dr. Foster. We have to stay on the air. The public needs facts. What do you have to give?
TV Man 2.
Well, there are several things we know for sure. You asked why they kill. They kill for one reason. They kill for food.
Dr. Foster said, as if in a trance. He had his suit jacket off and was mopping his brow with a handkerchief.
They eat their victims. You understand that, Mr. Burns?
He asked carefully, as though speaking to a child.
That's what keeps them going.
A wave of nausea overcame Fran, and she had to lean against the hallway wall in the shadows. People frantically rushed past her as though running to catch a train. She tried to calm herself and listen to the argument. TV station employees were filing past her, some leaving the studio in disgust.
If we'd listened, if we dealt with this phenomenon properly, without emotion, it wouldn't have come to this.
Dr. Foster pleaded with a thinning crowd.
Quiet down.
Absent in both the screenplay and the novelization is the arrival of Steven, a white man with brown hair and a bomber jacket. Before he can enter the studio, he's stopped by a guard.
Hold him. Where's your badge? Need a badge.
The camera pans backwards over the shoulders of Dr. Foster and Mr. Berman. We see most of the remaining crew of WGON-TV. Too numerous to list now, we will address them later. Foster wiped his sweat-drenched brow with the now-soaked, dirty handkerchief. He pulled his tie away from his tight collar and popped his shirt button open. The once calm, collected doctor was now a bundle of nerves, desperate, shivering with anger and frustration. Fran had never seen so radical a change come over a person. She herself was shivering now, and clutched her shoulders in the thin blouse. She felt so tired, so worn out, she just wanted to lie down and forget the whole mess. But the rasping, hoarse voice of Dr. Foster droned on, begging the people to hear his cry.
Should we be unable to check the spread because of the emotional attitudes of the citizenry toward these issues of morality?
The prior material was excerpted from the 1977 working draft for the motion picture Dawn of the Dead by George A. Romero, sound clips from the film itself, and elements from the novelization by Susanna Sparrow.
Welcome to the commentary for Dawn of the Dead. Ken Forey would like to introduce.
This is David Emge.
This is Scott Reiniger.
And the beautiful
Galen Rusk.
Since we ran a little long last episode to wrap up with Givens.
Oh, my
Dan
God.
Dan Dietrich,
who's no longer with us.
Oh, really?
But yeah,
no is he gone?
Yes,
yeah,
he's
gone.
That's too bad.
Dan Dietrich. Yeah.
There's only about 40 seconds of ground to cover this time. We spent a lot of time on the floor of the studio in this minute, with a bunch of folks that I haven't yet been able to identify. There are at least 13 actors in one shot that I can name maybe a third of, like the guy with glasses and a beard who does that weird, spastic, stiff-armed, jerking protest. The actors Bobby Van Emmon and Josephine Cusaro are seen looking on, while Vincent Vaughn has a smoke. I know that it's the 70s, but there is a sign on the door that Steven enters through that reads, "No smoking, food, or drinks." But hey, I guess it is the end of the world as we know it. Pretty much much all of Ed Leteri and Donna Siegel's time is spent here, as they brush past Steven on the way out of the studio, warning him of the madness that awaits inside. Given that Leteri's character is the one that tosses a handful of index cards at Foster and Berman, he's one to talk. Jim Edmondson reins things in as best he can, seemingly giving direction to a cameraman through hand gestures and his headset. I don't know the security guard with the mutton chops that hassles Steven. My tendency is to think of the European edit as being shorter, but I suppose Dario Argento appreciated the tension being ratcheted up by this sequence. So everything runs a bit longer here than in Romero's cuts. There's a 14th man seen in that one wide shot that looks kind of like a fat Isaac Asimov. Dr. Foster calls the crew assholes on live TV, and we see a bit more of them screaming back at him. The security guard even gets a few lines of dialogue. Given how heavily Dr. Foster was centered upon in this minute, you'd think I'd devote the episode to him. However, we've done three performer memorial episodes in a row, and now we're on to a fourth. The weight of my sense of responsibility to these departed creatives has made this project even more intimidating to me than the prospect of covering the material itself. It's already overwhelming for me to take on one of my all-time favorite movies at this level of detail, and fretting over the abundance of obituaries has led to months-long interruptions in what promises to be a lengthy series of podcasts. So let's do this last memorial for the time being, and then maybe we can get the show out more than twice a year. Because at this rate, somebody's going to have to do my obituary for this podcast. Credits in Minute 5 include production manager Zilla Clinton, assistant producer Donna Siegel, assistant director Christine Forrest, and director of photography Michael Gornick. We will not be addressing any of those credits in this minute. They'll have plenty of time later on, and of course, Christine Forrest was covered pretty thoroughly on the second episode. Instead, with this episode, we're going to focus on the TV talk show host that we were just listening to, Mr. Berman, and more specifically, the actor playing him.
David Early. I see David occasionally.
Yeah, we've done shows together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who the hell is that camera to? Call the rescue. Call the rescue station.
I'm not so sure you believe the dead are returning to life and attacking the living.
I'm not so sure what to believe, Doctor. All we get is what you people tell us. And it's hard enough to believe.
It's fact. It's fact.
It's hard enough to believe without you coming in here and...
You're not running a talk show here, Mr. Berman. You can forget pitching an audience the moral bullshit they want to hear.
The first 5 minutes, and it's a powerful scene. George told me and David that he needed our scene to be really energetic and all this kind of stuff because it's the lead-in to the rest of the movie.
David Early and I, who was my scene partner, he was the interviewer, had been in some plays together, so we were used to working together.
And I said, look, we got this part, this role together. Why don't we get together and run some lines so when we get there, we're ready.
It was at WPGH Studios, Channel 53. In the North Hills.
I said, well, George, we rehearsed a little bit. And he says, really?
People aren't willing to accept your solutions, Doctor, and I, for one, don't blame them.
Every dead body that is not exterminated becomes one of them. It gets up and kills. The people it kills get up and kill.
I think he bought the first take.
Then later, he gave me this hug, and George is big. I mean, he can pick me up off the floor, but it's like giving me that big bear hug. I mean, that's George.
I was thinking, yeah, this film acting is really easy.
David L. Early was born in the East Liberty section of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on May the 30th, 1938, growing up with brothers Emery and Kenneth. After graduating high school, he served in the Navy and Merchant Marine. After his discharge, he earned a bachelor's in elementary education and became a teacher. Following a brief period in Los Angeles, Early and his wife decided that they preferred to raise their family back in Pittsburgh, which included daughter Davina Reed and son Joseph Early, as well as a niece named Sabrina Crawford, who was raised as a sibling to the children. Early enjoyed performing for his children, including puppetry, and became a staple of the Pittsburgh theater scene. He performed in I'm Not Rappaport, Samuel Hazo's solos, readings of Ray Bradbury stories for the Prime Stage Theater, and offered numerous charity performances for the Off the Record comedy series. After his screen debut as talk show host Mr. Berman in 1978's Dawn of the Dead, Early followed with a television show appearance that was as different a showcase as Night from Day. Fred Rogers began working in children's television in 1953, finally starting his own show on Canadian public television in 1961. When Rogers moved back to the States in 1966, he brought the show with him, setting it up out of WQED in Pittsburgh. While the show initially struggled for funding and was at one point canceled, it was eventually picked up by National Educational Television, a precursor to public broadcast television. Beginning in 1968, the most familiar incarnation of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood ran for 31 seasons, for a total of 912 daily episodes, including specials. However, legacy numbering from the prior versions adds up to closer to 1,500 episodes. There were 65 episodes per year produced produced through 1975, while the other seasons were only about 5 to 15 episodes each. The series went on hiatus from 1976 to 1978, but returned for 15 episodes in the 1979 and 1980 season. The first week was themed Mr. Rogers Goes to School. Episode 1462, the second of the season, first aired on August 28, 1979. The episode was about counting and what kids could expect when entering kindergarten and first grade. David Early made a guest appearance toward the end of the episode as the first grade teacher giving Mr. Rogers a tour of his class.
Think I could see the first grade now?
Oh, you certainly can.
Good. Which way is it?
Just down here to the left. Mr. Early is our first grade teacher. He has two children of his own, you know.
Well, I'll be glad to meet him.
I'm always so happy when my children go to Mr. Early's first grade.
Is this it?
Yes.
What a big room.
Hello, Mrs. Hartman.
Hello, Mr. Early. How are you today?
Good, and you?
I'm just fine. I'd like you to meet Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Rogers?
Mr. Early, our first grade teacher.
Glad to know you, Mr. Early.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Mrs. Hartman has shown me the kindergarten and what they do over there, and I wanted my television friends to know something about the first grade, too.
I'd be glad to show you.
I was sure that you would be. I've got to get back to my room now. I have a lot of work to do.
Okay, Mrs. Hartman.
Goodbye.
Thanks again, Mrs. Hartman. Mm-hmm. She's a great person.
And a great teacher, too.
Yeah. Well, I see you've been stringing up a film here.
Oh, yeah. Well, we showed a film in the first grade, you know, as well as a lot of other things.
Well, what are some of the differences that you think there are between kindergarten and the first grade?
Well, one of the differences might be that in the first grade, our children have their own individual working space. As you can see here, they have their books here and pencils and their own personal belongings.
Well, they each have a desk.
Yes, their own desk and chair. Let me see. Some other
differences
might be that we begin our formal training here. Let's say learn our reading and writing and numbers. I can see our bulletin boards, the colors and ABCs, and vowel signs.
Well, before the children come, they don't have to know the alphabet and the numbers before they get here, do they?
Oh, no, not at all. That's what the first grade is here for. Actually, all the children need is to come with a willingness to learn and be a good listener. And
I've got a willingness to learn, Mr. Early. Would you teach me something?
Sure. Okay, look at my face.
All right.
Now, how many eyes do I have?
Two.
How many mouths do I have?
One.
How many ears do I have?
Two.
How many hairs do I have on my head?
Hairs on your head?
Yes.
I wouldn't be able to count them, Mr. Early. You have a lot of hair.
Well, do you know that the average person has 113,000 hairs on their head?
113,000? I didn't know that.
Well, see, you learned something. Now, why don't you teach me something?
Oh, what could I teach you? Do you have a piano?
Sure, we have an electric piano right here.
Well, let me think. I could show you something here. Do you play the piano?
Oh, yes, I do.
Well, if you would play this just over and over again, I'll show you what you could do down here to make that sound different.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rogers. I can show this to some of my children.
Sure, they can play this part, and you can play this part.
Right, that's great. Well, how about an apple for the teacher?
Well, thank you. An apple from the teacher. Hey, do you ever use the oranges and bananas in your math work?
Oh, sure. And we also learn about how they feel and how they grow on different trees and especially how they taste. Children like that.
Mm-hmm. I'll know how this tastes after a while. Thank you for that. I think I'd like to start first grade all over again.
Well, you're welcome to come back anytime you want, Mr. Rogers.
Thanks so much.
Well, I have an orientation session to get ready for, but it's been a pleasure having you here with us today.
Good to meet you.
Thank you.
See you again.
Bye now.
Bye, Mr. Early.
In 1981, Early scored a small role in a season 6 episode of Quincy ME, starring Jack Klugman. and was one of the Romero regulars to turn up in his Renfest biker flick, Knight Riders. Arguably his second most memorable role after Mr. Berman was in 1982's Creepshow, the beloved EC Comics-style horror anthology teaming George Romero and Stephen King. In the infamous final segment, They're Creeping Up on You, E.G. Marshall plays a Howard Hughes-style agoraphobic millionaire germaphobe with an Ebenezer Scrooge twist of cruelty. Obsessed with killing cockroaches in his otherwise sterile luxury high-rise, Upston Pratt insists on a late-night visit from the building superintendent. David Early plays Mr. White through a peephole in the front door.
Talk to me. Who's there?
Good evening there, Mr. Pratt. Got bugs again, huh, Mr. Pratt?
Don't you talk to me like that, you hear?
What way, Mr. Pratt?
Like I was crazy.
Oh, no, sir, Mr. Pratt, sir. I don't think you is crazy, not at all. I was just trying to run down in my mind who might have a 24-hour fumigating service. I might be able to get Pirelli Brothers out here by, shall we say, 11:30?
You might go far, White.
I've noticed that in service jobs, people like yourself often do. People of color. Yes, 11:30 would be fine. Thanks, Mr. Pratt, sir.
I'll call them just as soon as I finish with that shower on 23.
Do it first. Do it now.
Yes, sir.
Right now.
Following the death by suicide of a professional rival that Upton Pratt had destroyed, the apartment is overrun by roaches during a blackout, sending Pratt into a panic.
White! White, talk to me! White! White, I know you can hear me. The PA's on the emergency circuit. White, talk to me!
Mr. Pratt, I'm stuck in the damn elevator.
You can't be stuck in the elevator. I want you up here right now. There's bugs, roaches,
animals. I'm going to be here till the power comes on. Sorry.
I'll take it out, you black bastard.
Eventually, Upson Pratt locks himself in a glass panic room, which still has a phone line and proves less than impregnable.
You'll never get in here. Never. And when this blackout is over, people are going to pay. Oh, yes. And you'll pay, too. Every one of you. Every damn one of you. I've been beating bugs all my life. And I'll beat you, too. Bastards. Talk to me.
You old monster. Oh, I hope you die. I hope you die. I hope you die. I hope you die.
11 x 2 0 1 x 2 3 4 x 4 4 2 x 4 4 3 4 4 Mr. Pratt? You there, Mr. Pratt? Mr. Pratt, talk to me.
talk to me.
Ultimately, the lights come back on, and the apartment is cleared of any signs of the bugs. In the end, it is revealed that the legions of cockroaches have infiltrated Pratt's body, killing him before erupting from every orifice and filling the panic room several feet high. It's a truly iconic moment of horror.
What's the matter, Mr. Pratt? Bugs got your tongue?
By the way, the roach wrangler from Creepshow, Ray Mendez, was also the moth wrangler for The Silence of the Lambs, filmed in Pittsburgh with David Early. Mendez has his own sequence in the documentary Inside the Labyrinth, which was included in the special edition DVD release and is also on the Criterion Collection's version of the Blu-ray. Early also appeared on a Laurel television episode of Tales from the Dark Side. which starred Jerry Stiller as a Morton Downey-style controversial radio talk show host. Unfortunately, I couldn't find it streaming anywhere, legally or illegally, so I couldn't check it out. David Early did one of those Frasier-style call-ins, and that was his credit. Early had a handful of cameos in the late 80s, featured in films like The Prince of Pennsylvania and George Romero's Monkey Shines, before turning up in the Best Picture Oscar winner of 1991, and he had a familiar cohort in tow.
Even though the story was set in Tennessee and Washington and West Virginia, we hoped to find one place where we could do all of that.
Kenny Utt and Jonathan Demme had been canvassing the world looking for the right city to place this story in. And the one that kept us all very intrigued was Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh has a kind of coal and steel background, and the fact that it has many hills and rivers, and it's just packed with character. There was a wealth of locations there that were unbelievable and had never been filmed before.
The great monumental buildings that are there.
The Natural History Museum, the Soldiers and Sailors Museum.
All the other elements came together in the small towns around there, provided some of the West Virginia look.
Being a Pittsburgh production with numerous George Romero alumni, it probably should not be surprising that the big man himself makes an appearance in 1991's The Silence of the Lambs. George is one of the FBI agents present during Clarice Starling's final face-to-face with Dr. Hannibal Lecter in Memphis, and is present for the determined rookies being forcefully escorted out of the building.
All right, let's go.
Give me his name, Doctor.
Out.
I fucked up.
Finish.
Oh, wait, that was just an outtake. But here he is speaking on the walkie-talkie and giving a last troubled backward glance at Lecter.
Dr. Chilton, I presume. I think you know each other.
Okay. Let's go.
It's your turn, Doctor.
Out.
Tell me his name.
Sorry, ma'am, I've got orders. I had to put you on a plane. Come on now.
Brave Clarice. Well, let me know when those lambs stop screaming, won't you?
Tell me his name, Doctor.
Clarice! Your case filed. Goodbye, Clarice.
David Early has a small role as one of the Memphis PD assigned to guard Hannibal Lecter. He's first seen in the lobby, drinking coffee and reading a newspaper. After shots are heard and the elevator changes floors, Early joins a squad of officers in the stairwell, carefully making their way to the cage where Lecter was being held.
Pember!
Two officers down.
Clear!
Lecter's gone, Sarge.
Prisoner's missing.
Boyle's gun is gone, Sergeant.
Repeat, Lecter's missing and armed. He stripped the bed. Might be making a rope, check all windows. Where the fuck is my ambulance?
He's alive. Sergeant Tate, he's alive.
Get a hold of him or you can feel his hands, son. Talk to him.
What do I say?
It's Jim Pimmery. Now talk to him, damn it. Lecter's missing and armed.
Ray, Pimmery, can you hear me?
He took Boyle's gun. Pimmery got off one round. There's a chance Lecter was hit.
Keep breathing in and out. That's it. You're doing a good job. Oh, you look real good there.
Early is the one that determines that one of the officers that had been savaged by Lecter in his escape had apparently gotten a round off, making it appear as though Hannibal the Cannibal had been wounded while fleeing the scene. In a way, we get to see what it would have looked like if Early had been on the SWAT team with Peter and Roger, and he comes out of his situation better than they did theirs. Early eventually returned to the University of Pittsburgh, this time as an instructor, where he taught theater arts for over two decades as part of the Pittsburgh Filmmakers, specializing in acting for the camera. He took part in the Pittsburgh Public Theater Education Outreach Program, as well as an apprenticeship program. One of his partners in the program, Rob Zellers, has been quoted as saying that it was part drama, part team building, part sociology lesson. The program is still going strong today. Of Early himself, Zeller stated that, he said to me once that he could not have asked for a better life than he'd had in Pittsburgh. To be able to act on local stages, appear in films, and most importantly, affect so many young lives. I believe if he had one final message for his students, he would have reminded them always to find the flow and courageously remove the mask. Through his teaching and acting, David Early was a consistent presence among Pittsburgh productions, both in front of and behind the camera. Notable films include Double Dragon, John Landis's Innocent Blood, and another instance of Romero adapting King in The Dark Half. His last two mainstream appearances were the Katherine Heigl Vigil, One for the Money, and Kevin Smith's Zack and Miri Make a Porno. Ironically, Zack and Miri was the first movie I saw with my longtime girlfriend on a double date with my buddy Il Mac and his future wife. I wasn't aware of its many Dawn of the Dead tie-ins, seeing it mostly on the strength of Seth Rogen and my enjoyment of Clerks 2. The movie is set in Monroeville. Miri works at the mall. Tom Savini has a cameo. Zack plays in an amateur hockey team called the Monroeville Zombies. And David Early auditions for the movie within a movie.
Next!
Cradle the balls. Work the shaft.
Jerk my cum crayon and let me color you white.
I need cock and I need it now.
I'm fucking you in the puss.
I'm fucking you in the puss.
It's puss as in pussy.
Oh, because I was like, who would want to fuck puss?
David L. Early turned up in a few ultra-low-budget features toward the end, his last role in 2012. He passed away on March 23rd, 2013 from cancer at his daughter's home in Clearwater, Florida at the age of 74. Speak Korean, so bear with me on these pronunciations. Presumably anticipating the enormous success of the 2016 South Korean zombie epic Train to Busan, director Yeon Sang-ho decided to also write an animated prequel that arrived just a month after Busan's release. Seoul Station is a smaller, bleaker, and much more vicious film. For the record, Sang-ho got his start in animation, and the long lead time there means that Seoul Station literally preceded the production of Train to Busan by a year, so you could argue the semantics of which is the prequel or the sequel. For comparison, Train is about an absentee father more concerned about his career than his family, given perspective on his lapsed humanity when forced to protect his daughter, and ultimately his fellow man. Seoul Station is about society ignoring the homeless and developmentally challenged so completely that the zombie apocalypse breeds in their community to such a degree that it collapses said society. Its hero include a lazy, misogynistic gamer nerd who tries to turn out his abuse survivor girlfriend for rent money, and the violent paternal figure that she was forced to escape. In Busan, you hope for some measure of happiness to be found for the passengers.
hours.
In Soul Station, you simply dread how much worse the situation will likely get for people ill-equipped to deal with the hardships of regular life, much less the heightened circumstances of high-speed super zombies. Actually, compared to Busan, the undead of Soul Station are rather languid, but they're still quite spry by Romero standards. Recognizing that a straight-to-video animated gore fest is decidedly niche, Soul Station bears down confidently into sordid grimdark, recalling such diverse works as Midnight Cowboy, early Cronenberg, and even a touch of John Sayles. He soon is distraught over her boyfriend's proposition and wanders away from him toward a sprawling train station in Seoul. A virus has been spreading unimpeded among the homeless population that sleep in and around the station after hours, and is beginning to expand exponentially to outside neighborhoods. Barefoot and alone, he soon is eventually befriended by an older man with some mental instability and a grudge against the class system of South Korean society. Meanwhile, the middle-aged Suk-goo had hired a private investigator to find his runaway daughter, leading him to boyfriend Ki-woong, who is bullied into finding Hee-soon in the midst of this brutal epidemic. The story escalates further and further out of control, as our protagonists face not only the rampaging cannibalistic undead, but also the draconian countermeasures of authorities seeking to contain the spread, with little regard for any lower classes caught up in their hastily erected quarantine barricade. I personally am not a huge fan of anime or animation in general, but Soul Station's realistic art style is more reminiscent of the odd French effort than anything you typically expect to see out of Japan. It's full of sexual and social politics, with a view of policing more in line with BLM than Blue Lives Matter, even as its underdog subjects aren't so sympathetic that you feel certain that you should root for them. This is a film about sadness, and not just impending doom, but the inevitable one of people caught in these straits. I can't say that it's anywhere near as enjoyable or exhilarating as the film it was spun off from, but I can say that it's immediately clear that it never intended to be such. Soul Station is an adult animated feature for people who don't like cartoons, with a surprisingly art house mentality. Its commentary is much more in line with Romero's conscientious objections than the thrill ride of a World War Z, or even the survivalist soap opera of The Walking Dead. Yes, there is zombie horror, but there's more than a little of our common day-to-day horror, living in a global neoliberal dystopia in perhaps the last century of a humankind lacking in kindness. Our updated list of rescue stations include the 20th Century Geek Podcast, Adriano, Ann Labs, Chris Thompson, Dirk Ashton, who offered a curtsying Alice in Wonderland gif, Grave Girls Podcast, who offered a Shaun of the Dead bashing Shaun and Ed gif, which prompted CJ to reply with the quote, "The Batman soundtrack, throw it." El Romero Romero, Illegal Machine, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Into the Weird, Just in Time with the J&T Baggers, Keith G. Baker, King Dinosaur, The List Game, Michael Robert, Randy Caldwell, who wrote, Ah, Jadzia Dax, Damn You, Sam Malone, and Gul Dukat. I didn't watch Becker. I was too busy mourning Jadzia and maintaining my unrequited platonic dislike of Ezri. She was acceptable, if not okay. It's not her fault she wasn't an alien demigoddess. Reverend Odell Abner Dracula, Richard G., Richard Van Ingram, Schlocktopus, Shanna Banana, who wrote, Cool, thank you, Talk Nerdy to Me, Tim Mason, and Xenozoic Xenophiles.